home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson. Garrett Miller, I almost got Garrett to join us tonight, but he was completely exhausted, and I really don't blame him. You have to have a little bit of energy to do what we do here. And so he was completely spent, and that's that. So we will have him on doing his Blonde Jesus stuff and telling us about other things in the world of entertainment very soon, but not tonight. That is not to say that we do not have an enormously powerhouse show for you tonight. We absolutely do. Not only is it a powerhouse show, we have a really, really important topic that is not coming up into the level of consciousness in public media. And we'll talk about that, why it isn't. But it's important things are going on. And in this discussion tonight, we have somebody who is front and center of the fight. And he's going to tell us about what he's been advocating, pushing for, and fighting for. We also have my very good friend, Brody Levesque, who is a journalist, political journalist. And I've asked Brody to join because Brody can give sort of the perspective of this situation in conjunction with the lay of the land politically of everything that is going on, which is a lot. It's confusing and it's nuts and it's wild. And this story is as wild and nuts and actually underhanded as the rest of it. So what is going on is trans military people, those who want to serve, those who are serving, are literally being attacked by a fairly small group, but still powerful group of legislatures in the GOP in Congress. And they have, as a lot of things have been going on, and if you're like me, you're watching, you know, Trump and Russian meetings and, you know, talking to Putin at dinner parties and, you know, global warming and, you know, healthcare and wishy-washiness on healthcare and, you know, what kind of father he is and where his stuff is made and all of that stuff is going on. Well, also going on, which we're probably not paying attention to, is budget time up on Capitol Hill. And if you're like me, that sounds super boring, numbers crunching, whatever, you know, yes, tighten belts, this, that, and the other thing, you know, no big deal. Well, that is where the new battlefield has been drawn, to cut out transgender rights out of their, what they deserve to have provided for them in conjunction with their service in the military. And they've been targeted, and it is along the lines of bathroom bills and everything else, where the transgender community is not only targeted, they're targeted with things that virtually makes it impossible for them to operate their human lives, and which makes it the cruelest thing of all. So that's the overlay there. My guest tonight, as I said, these are high-powered, heavy hitters that we have joining us tonight, is Matthew Thorne, who is the executive director of OutSurf SLDN. Matt, I know from my inbox because of all the do not, don't ask, don't tell, and all of the things that I've been watching on sidelines, his name is all over that stuff. And again, Brody Levesque, who is, I can't say enough about Brody, as a seasoned journalist, word of wisdom out there, keeping us all honest and keeping the people who don't want to be honest, honest, which is an amazing feat. First up, I want to welcome Matt to the program. If I can get the buttons to work.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm happy
Matt.
To be here.
Welcome
Hi.
To the show. I now got the mic turned on for you. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. Great. So, what before I bring Brody on, what can you characterize this a little further on what? Let's actually go back a step. What has happened since Don't Ask, Don't Tell? I mean, a lot of the population is sitting back thinking, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they're all taken care of. Is that the case?
not entirely. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell was legislatively repealed in December of 2010 under President Obama's first term, and it was signed by him after, and then there was it was officially lifted in September of 2011. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell only allowed lesbian, gay, and bisexual individuals to serve openly in the military. The military at that point still had a ban on transgender service members, which was lifted last summer, or the process started to be lifted last summer under Secretary Carter, President Obama's last Secretary of Defense. So our retention policy, which is those who are currently serving, was fully put into place in October of 2016, and now we're in the process of working on the accessions policy. So anybody who wants to join the military, either through ROTC or the academies, or enlistment, or a recruiter, that policy is still not in place yet, and we're trying to work on getting that implemented, hopefully by the end of this year. And then there's a number of other smaller policies and things that need to be addressed within DOD. I think for the average American to understand this, DOD has roughly about a $650 billion budget. So, and it's the largest federal agency that we have. So obviously when you do something and you have a massive change in policy, it's not always going to be as smooth as everybody wants it to be. So there's little things that need to be tweaked here and there as we continue to move forward.
And before we move on with the story, I do want to welcome Brody onto the show. Good evening, Brody.
Hey, guys. Good evening, Matt.
So, Matt,
good
I
evening,
want to continue,
Brody.
Though, with the what has gone on before. What has been, as these things have come about, really easing in Don't Ask, or the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, over time, what kind of opposition, if any, has there been on the process? Have the transgender joining slowed at all, or is that just what should be administratively expected?
Under President Obama, things progressed, I would say probably pretty quickly. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I think people forget, was congressionally enacted in 1993. So it was 20 plus years or close that it almost, until it was actually repealed by Congress. So it's been a long history for LGBT individuals in the military to get to where we are today. And there's always going to be opposition. There was opposition when the military wanted to integrate with African Americans. There was opposition with bringing women into the force. There's opposition currently with women entering combat. So there's always going to be somebody in this country who just doesn't appreciate or, have a viewpoint that equality and an equal standard is the right way to be. And that's one of the fundamental points of the military, is everyone is treated equal across the board.
Right. Which is, if you're in business or in any kind of large organization, as soon as you deviate from a real hardline equality stance, you are really going into chaos. I mean, it's not even just that it's right; it turns everything into a mess. Brody, what is the public opinion right now? If we went out there, and I'm sure you have this information innate, but if we went out there to the public and said, what do you think of transgender individuals serving in the military. Where is the population standing currently?
In some of the polls that we've seen and in some of the polls that have been taken, the vast majority of the American people don't have an issue with this. When you start talking about specific polling within Republican circles and you start talking about specific models within certain set groups such as evangelicals, Pentecostals, and the folks that would normally be opposed to any form of equilibrium for the LGBTQI community, obviously the numbers are, quite frankly, skewed. The overall impression that we're getting, and this is from the various polling firms, is that most Americans, honestly, at this stage, you know, they don't care. The main thing is that they see it as a matter of character, not gender identity or sexual orientation. And I think that really goes to the heart of what the overall issue is. And this is probably the number one thing that Matt and the other members of the LGBTQI advocacy movement are constantly working towards in terms of perception. The fallacy of thinking here, Rob, is that Capitol Hill reflects the greater population, and the truth of the matter is it doesn't. So that's where the numbers get skewed.
Yeah, no, I would say that's almost an understatement right now in this world, Brody, in terms of Capitol Hill representing the general population in almost an appalling, absurd reality to the other direction on that. Matt, so take us to this current situation. We're humming along here. Things are going okay with the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, transgender service members getting, you know, easing into a position of where they should be in the military. To Brody's point, the public is, you know, kind of on board, and all of a sudden this budget hits Congress. What happens next?
Well, I mean, the retention, you know, nothing has changed with the retention policy with the Department of Defense. Everybody, if you are currently serving, if you are a transgender individual who's currently serving, if you are a transgender individual who's currently serving, you know, that policy is in effect. DOD has been doing its educational trainings, which are required as diversity and inclusion trainings, with the full force. So that's still in place. Obviously, the big thing that's changed is in November, we elected the current president to office, which comes with a Republican administration and then coupled with a Republican Congress that hasn't flipped. So we obviously were very cognizant of that and very concerned about that and what that could impact, because there are members of Congress that are not in line on our issues, and we're monitoring that. And then about every June, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the projects that DOD wants to work on, Congress finds appealing. So every year the NDAA comes up for renewal and outlines those projects. And we were given notice, gotten a heads up.
Sorry, Matt, I
wanted
to ask you, NDAA stands for what again?
Oh, sorry, National Defense Authorization Act.
Okay.
It's a guideline.
I sit here knowing nothing because I can ask all the questions that people don't know. So
no
that
problem.
Act, yeah.
Go ahead.
That act has come up for renewal, and what happened to that? That happening not so smoothly.
So Congress has to pass it every year. So this year, one of the members of the Armed Services Committee, because that is where the National Defense, the NDAA, goes through committee. One of the members, Representative Vicky Hartzler, was shopping around an amendment for an all-out ban on transgender service members. And she's from Missouri, a very conservative part of Missouri, and was attempting to get the amendment attached to the NDAA, which essentially the overall aspect of the NDAA is that it's essentially a must-pass bill for Congress. Luckily, we were able to outmaneuver her on that and have her withdraw that amendment. So we were good on committee. And then she attempted to try to, whatever I'm sure a lot of people have seen in the press last week and a half, she attempted to try to attach an amendment on the floor of the House of Representatives to the NDAA, which was more specific and targeted transgender individuals' health care and dependents of service members. So it wasn't just transgender service members. It was also service members who may or may not have a trans child and some transgender veterans and dependents of veterans who are still covered under TRICARE.
So a couple of things, a couple of follow-up questions on both those things you just mentioned. One is there any precedent at all for Congress to limit health care to any specific individuals in the service? In other words, that this group or you know, we're not going to cover this aspect of health care, period. I mean, it just seems very, number one, unusual. Number two, very difficult in practice to determine what just falls into those broad brush categories.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I can't even, Brody from his, you know, from the political reporter landscape might be able to be more definitive on this, but to my knowledge, in all the years that I've worked in Washington, there has never been a case where Congress has attempted to limit health care for service members.
Right.
That, and I think that is really the absurdity of it.
Yeah. So they're not, there's no bill out there, for example, saying no Viagra for the colonels or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, the Pentagon has, you know, personnel policies, and obviously, like, so TRICARE is kind of like any other health care that anybody has. Your plan covers X, Y, and Z, so forth, but there's been no definitive legislative action from Congress to completely ban a particular thing for service members. I mean, and we're talking, we're not talking, you know, like, a Viagra issue. We are talking pretty much anything for transgender service members or dependents, except for mental health care. So that's hormone therapy. That's, I mean, like, it runs the gamut. I mean, we're talking about a very swath, you know, a big brush attempt that she was making to completely, you know, annihilate health care for trans individuals, making it essentially impossible for them to serve.
Right. Well, it's the effect of it is obvious. What I'm still asking about is, even in the legal thought process behind it, because once you step away from this individual may not get this service, when you're talking about hormone therapies, physical surgeries, all of those things, there are other people who, if you put another label on them, are probably going to want or need those surgeries. And so there seems to be like just a flat out, equal treatment under the law issue that could be put on the table on this.
Oh, fine. I mean, like, 100%. Our argument, if had it passed, our argument was that it was unconstitutional to begin with, and we felt confident in our analysis that we would more than likely win in court if we had gotten to that point. The way that it was worded was broad. The way in which she targeted individuals was very specific, and to your point, it was, you know, like, we're talking about equal treatment, and I really think that that's where both the moderates who voted with us to kill the amendment and the Defense Department kind of stepped in and were like, you know, that's, you know, this is going too far and absurd.
Right. So let's back up to the core of bizarre and absurd and cruel and mean and horrible person. What in the world got in her craw in the first place? Do you have any sense of why, of all the things she could be worrying her little head about, that she went after this group of people in this particular aspect of public service?
Actually, I can answer that question. But go ahead,
Brody. Brody can jump in. I'm sure.
We were looking at the issue, trying to attempt to discern what got her and her fellow members of the Armed Services Committee that were more or less backing her with her amendment, what got them fired up. And we traced it back to early May, when an article had been published by Gannett in the USA Today that had been talking about the accession policy that Matt just mentioned. And there was a unfortunate series of events that we've since learned that occurred as a result of the publication of that article. And that was is that the particular matters revolving around even what later became her amendment or trans service wasn't actually on her or anybody else's radar screen in terms of making a bunch of noise. And the push for this actually came from a very conservative right-wing think tank in Washington called the Heritage Foundation, along with assistance from the Family Research Council, which is a so-called family values Christian group also located in Washington. We later learned that these folks had gone and gotten the vice president of the United States fired up. So what ended up happening was there was a constant back and forth, and then our sources were telling us that the vice president basically started trolling through the House Armed Services Committee and landed on Hartzler's desk. And so there's the genesis for what later became the action that Matt and the members of the LGBTQI equality movement ended up having to fight this last week. So that's the genesis for why Representative Hartzler got all fired up. Now, I will also say that Representative Hartzler has a long track record in Missouri and in public statements in her service on the Hill against LGBTQ equality of any stripe. She's made public statements after the Supreme Court decisions. She's made other unfortunate statements. She's very much in the pocket of the right wing. And again, it was no surprise, I think, at least to those of us in the press corps, that this became the path that she decided to go with. But Matt can answer the other part of the question.
Matt, did you have any other feedback on that?
I mean, I think that Brody has Brody's coming from an outside perspective. You know, being in the movement and listening to everything that we're hearing is far different sometimes than what the reporters are getting, which tends to be, you know, more broad and under and or more expansive in their reach. So, you know, I think that's more than likely pretty accurate. We had gotten to the point by the end of May where this issue had not come up until a few press articles that started running at the end of May. And then things just kind of really just spiraled from there. And I think that we're dealing with, I think that organizations like Heritage Foundation and Family Research Council are far more emboldened now, given the fact that, you know, in their minds, they control Congress and the White House. So I think that this was a way for them to think that they had an opportunity to do something on this issue. And I think that, you know, because we're talking about the estimate is about 15,500 transgender service members. So it's not a huge, the number compared to the overall military is not a very large number. So I think that, you know, my interpretation would be like it's a small enough population that I think that they felt like they could target and win on this issue. But I agree with Brody's assessment as well.
So politically, what is the situation right now? I mean, you've got the vice president, and ironically, there was this meme going around, a picture from him from his fraternity days where he was dressed in what could only be described as a provocative go-go boy type outfit. ironically similar to pictures that have surfaced of Marco Rubio, who is also a major homophobe. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's there. There's this arc between, you know, being homoerotic at a young age in whatever situation they happen to be photographed this way, to being homophobic, you know, as they get much more seasoned. But you've got that individual, and it seems to me, and I'm going to throw a theory out there and just get both of your input on it, is that while Trump is doing Russia things and global warming things and golf things and Twitter things and his son things and all of that, that Mike Pence is working towards a fabric that is very much in bed with the Heritage Foundation and all of that political ilk, and setting up a sort of just under the covers discrimination blanket on this and other things that are being presented quietly through the Congress. Is that a fair assessment of what's going on?
I think you could make that argument. I mean, the vice president obviously has, in under any administration, doesn't have as much power and influence as, you know, a president does. But I think Mike Pence is using this opportunity to definitely exert his influence, or what he perceives to be his influence, and his own personal, and I'll get in trouble for radical beliefs. I mean, when as governor of Indiana, he tried, you know, he signed a RFRA law, you know, that was similar to what happened in North Carolina and a number of other states. So, I mean, like, obviously he has no love for anything, you know, the LGBT community at all. From my perspective, yes, I think that there are certain things that he is doing to try to build that fabric. I will say, I think one deficit he has in trying to do that, though, is the president of the United States and the chaos that you all outlined with the Twitter and with the Russia investigation and with the emails. Because at the end of the day, the president has to be the one to sign the legislation. And a lot of people in Congress are going to, you know, for all his ill will and irks and craziness that comes out of that West Wing, you know, there is still a deference given to the Oval Office versus the vice president. I will say that I think the vice president has more influence on the House of Representatives, because he was a member for years, than he does on the U.S. Senate.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, the one thing I will observe, though, Matt, based on what you were just saying, though, is that I come from the corporate world, and I come from the, you know, CEO level, boardrooms type level, and I've actually worked for some CEOs who were, quite frankly, nuts. And the way the second in command and the lower level get things done in that environment is they placate the nuts guy. They kiss up to him. They, you know, what he says goes. They focus him on all of his little windmills, and he's out making big deals about it. And while all that stuff is going on, because he is not paying attention to anything else, they comfortably just step out and go do what they want to do or feel is necessary to do, or, you know, their own agenda. And that's how they actually, in this second tier level, subtly grab power within the organization. Now, that's the corporate world, not necessarily the government.
Yeah.
I just see these things sort of coming into place here.
Well, but, I think there's definitely an attempt by him to do it, right? I think there's, you know, there's a number of different avenues that don't necessarily translate from the corporate world here. You know, we have multiple different factions that are vying for President Trump's attention, right? He has his kids, who he listens to. He has Steve Bannon, he has Reince Priebus, and then he has the vice president, all that have different agendas and all that are not on the same page, which makes his play that much harder. And then I think the other aspect of that is Congress. You know, you're dealing with 535 members that have to be reelected every two, you know, 435 have to be reelected every 2 years. And then a third of the Senate is up every 2 years. So they all have their own agendas. And I think that complicates, you know, I would agree with you. I totally agree with you. In a corporate world, that's how they definitely get things done. And I don't dispute the fact that I think Pence is trying to do that. I think it is in the environment in which we are and how DC operates, how government operates. I think he's just not as efficient at it as he would have been in the governor's mansion in Indiana.
Right, right. So let's go back to the amendment gets attached in the House of Representatives. What do you guys do to fight it? You were right in the center of that. How did that get defeated?
Yeah, so we knew that she was going to try to attach it to the Rules Committee, which approves amendments to pieces of legislation before they go to the floor. To be voted on. So she proposed the amendment, not the one from committee, which was far more expansive. This narrowed her version of a narrowed amendment. And we knew that she was lobbying very, very hard to get this passed on the floor. Over the weekend, you know, the rumors were that she stayed in town and she was calling members personally. So a coalition of organizations, including, you know, Outs or Vessel DN, started working on members of Congress, Democrats, moderate Republicans. The disadvantage that we had kind of going into that week was the fact that we were coming off of the July 4th recess. So not everybody goes home, does their parades and their town halls and all of that stuff. So not everybody was back in town. And we were going into that week and we reached out to a source that we have at the Pentagon, and we were trying to take the Pentagon's temperature on where they were on amendments, and particularly Vicky Hartzler. And it's a very long story, a lot of, you know, phone calls back and forth, both with the Pentagon and with members of Congress. And we were going into the vote. The vote was on Thursday. Rules Committee made it in order with leadership's approval on Wednesday. Of that week, of the week of July 10th. And quite frankly, I think everyone was kind of on edge about whether or not we could actually carry it. Republicans still have a very large majority in the House of Representatives. We only have 193 Democrats. And really, it was going to require a lot of moderates to come over to support us to defeat the amendment. So it was lobbied very hard. And then we finally heard on Wednesday that the Secretary of Defense himself had met with Speaker Ryan and encouraged him to, there were a package of amendments that the Secretary did not want on the NDAA, one of which was the Hartzler Amendment. So he had asked Speaker Ryan, and Speaker Ryan was not going for it. He was going to let all of them go to the floor to be voted up or down. And then the Secretary that evening, Wednesday evening, called Vicky and asked her to withdraw the amendment. And she, I won't use the language that I was told on the air, but she essentially told him that she wasn't going to do it, that she was moving ahead with it. She felt confident that she had the votes for it. So we went into Thursday really iffy on where we were going to be. We had a number of representatives that were uncommittal. They were not no's, they were not yeses, they were just not telling us, or the other side for that matter, where they were going to vote on this issue. And then it started getting around that the Secretary was against the measure against the amendment, and that he had called her and asked her to withdraw. So we started getting a lot of requests from offices for phone calls from the Secretary. Which, you know, obviously he has a number of things going on, but we did pass those along. And at about 4:55 that evening, as they were going into the vote, we also asked the Pentagon if they would go on record, which they ended up doing the next day. They didn't do that afternoon. And at about 4:55, 5 o'clock, we got a phone call that he had made some last-minute phone calls. And then the vote was happening, and I was watching the vote, and it came in at 209-214. So we ended up flipping 23 Republicans to vote against the amendment.
Amazing.
That's a very short synopsis of what happened.
In the swirl after that, there was some scuttlebutt even on the progressive side on who was doing what and who was saying the right things. Can you add some clarity to that, where that misunderstanding was going on?
Can you be more specific? Only because I was doing our own communication, so I wasn't really kind of paying attention to everybody else's.
I think it was a Palm Group put out something that was mischaracterizing the situation, particularly the Secretary of Defense.
I mean, the Secretary of Defense is on record. His spokesperson put a statement out on Friday, the day after the vote, and said, you know, invalidated the fact that he called Representative Hartzler. I would also note that a very interesting line in his spokesperson's statement, I believe they gave it to CNN first, and then Task and Purpose also ran it. But the notable line, I think, in that statement was, if individuals are going to serve or are serving, they deserve to be treated like anybody else, and nobody deserves, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, nobody deserves to be treated less than. And it was a very notable line to me that they included that. Like I think in Task and Purpose article, they said that the spokesperson was very insistent on that being included. So I think that's a testament of where this current Secretary of Defense is sitting. I can't speak for any other group and what their interpretation is. I can speak to the fact that we've had a conversation with the Secretary's office. We know where they stood leading up to that vote. And then, you know, on Friday, they gave confirmation to that.
Excellent. And Brody, I know, putting kind of some human face on this issue. I think you talked to some prominent transgender individuals about this going on. What kind of reaction were actual trans people having to the fact this discussion was even happening?
I did. I talked to several transgender activists, and then I spoke to some very prominent transgender individuals. And I think from one statement that was made to me by Julia Scotti, the comedian from New Jersey, was, why don't they just leave us alone? I don't understand. Brody, if someone wants to serve their country, what's the big deal? That's a quote. And we heard this over and over again. There were two parts to this in talking with the trans community. The first part of it that was really, with at least some of the activists, that angered them was they were seeing a return to an exclusion policy by Congress, particularly the House Armed Services Committee and the Republican leadership. Now, and again, I need to specify, this was directed at the House, not the Senate. The other part of it was that they weren't terribly happy with the fact that there was some public comments being made. You mentioned the mischaracterization by Aaron Belkin, the director of the Palm Center, and I would tend to agree with that. He kept trying to frame the conversation in context of don't ask, don't tell, and that's completely and totally incorrect. That's not what the problem was. And as Matt outlined, the baseline issue here was trans service in its entirety. This wasn't a case of don't ask, don't tell. This was a case of we don't want them. And the trans folk, they just, you know, they've got people that are currently serving. They've had a couple people who have served successfully and had excellent careers in the U.S. military, including one who I believe is now a retired Navy SEAL. And so they just don't understand why they can't simply be able to do what everyone else does. And they were upset from the position that they didn't see that coming through. Now, the game changer, as Matt mentioned, was the fact that the Secretary of Defense apparently did step in. Now, several of us have attempted to get a little bit more detail, a little bit more information, and be litigated a little bit further by that, and the Pentagon's refusing to talk to us. My journalistic colleague and peer, Chris Johnson from the Washington Blade, he's the Washington Blade's White House reporter, tried to get some sort of commentary from the White House, and of course the White House wouldn't touch it either. So, and that speaks to yet another problem for the trans community, particularly trans service members, is that sometimes they feel as though they're invisible even within the LGBTQI movement. You know, they don't like being a political football, and they really are not appreciative of that fact. Now, obviously, I'm speaking as a political reporter. Matt can talk to this issue and address it, obviously, as an activist and as a head of an organization that specifically serves, you know, members of the armed forces. But I, this is just my take on it from what I've learned over the last few weeks. Matt, if you want to take it from me, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, from my perspective, for our movement, for the LGBT movement, you know, we have, this isn't President Obama's administration, far from it. This isn't even close to George W. Bush's administration, quite frankly. We have a responsibility to be strategic as we possibly can and to be as flexible as we possibly can. And I think that over the course of the last 60 days, you know, the secretary, given his actions on Hartzler, you know, one would take that action as, you know, he is not hostile towards the LGBT, you know, towards LGBT service members. And I would probably, and I agree with that. I don't think that he has a maliciousness towards our community at all. I think he's coming from a place of, given the fact that he delayed the accessions policy by another 6 months and some things that, you know, did get the ire of some groups of our, in our community. I think he's trying his best to navigate an environment that is not 100, you know, not even close to being favorable to him. He has a very hostile White House, as is evident by, you know, the vice president, and a president that is in constant chaos. And he has a Republican-controlled Congress, which controls his budget every year. So, you know, I don't think we are in a position as a movement where we are going to get the Secretary of Defense to walk in a pride parade with a rainbow flag. I think
right.
we are that's mm-hmm. never going to happen.
Right.
But the fact that he did step in and said to Vicky and said to Speaker Ryan, I do not want this amendment. And then, as I said earlier, with his statement on Friday to CNN, that his belief is that if you are going to serve, everyone deserves to be fundamentally treated equal. You know, that goes a long way, you know, and I think we have to be in an environment where we take the win that we can get. You know, we could have had Jeff Sessions was eyeing DOD, and we are seeing what he's doing with the Justice Department on LGBT issues. So, you know, I think we should be very fortunate that we have a secretary that, you know, is not, I won't call him a, you know, big ally that's going to be on a float in a pride parade, but we have
right.
a secretary who is willing to listen to our issues and who's willing to take that under consideration and do what he can in the best interest of all of his service members, which trans people serving is in that best interest. There is no issue in readiness or lethality of the force. Trans people have been serving for a very long time, openly since October, and there's been no issue. And I think that's where he's coming from. And I don't think that it's in our best interest to undercut that or nullify it. You know, yes,
right.
we might not be
right.
happy with some of the actions that he had to take, but he is navigating an environment fundamentally hostile towards us, and he is trying
right.
to do his best to protect those. I personally believe he's trying to do his best to protect the individuals he already has serving, let alone trying to get to the accessions policy. I mean, Vicky Hartzler made it very fundamentally clear with her amendment in committee that she wanted an all-out ban. So, you know, I mean, that's where we are.
Right. I want to get both your reactions to something that I believe has either come out or coming out from the other side. And I personally find this very subtly horrifying. And it reminds me, it's an ad, and it's an ad that reminds me of one that was done years ago around marriage equality. and gay parenting. And the old ad, the one years ago, was this picture of two men dressed, you know, they were dressed kind of a little bit bar scene-ish, you know, bald, you know, kind of bearded guys with a baby carriage. And it put out this ad kind of like, you know, isn't this terrible, was kind of the underplaying of this picture without saying anything, without, you know, having to exaggerate anything or make it more than it was, because it was hitting towards that ignorant and kind of myopic Americana picture of what, you know, a mom and a dad pushing a baby carriage looked like from sitcoms. And so it was closer to what reality would look like with two dads, but, you know, it juxtaposed it to against the common viewpoint so that they could sort of innately cause concern. There's an ad that is just coming out that shows a transgender woman, nothing outrageous, nice looking woman, and juxtapose her picture against some big missile plane thing. I'm sure that's the military technical term for it. It kind of puts this thing about, you know, which do you want our millions of dollars to go towards is the question. And that seems targeted towards that, you know, it's, you know, my white privileged cisgendered world mentality of, well, gee, we're paying for missiles and all that, not transgender stuff. What is your reactions to that, both of you guys?
Go ahead, Matt.
I mean, like, this is typical from, I believe the Family Research Council put out that image. One, it's an F-35 in that picture. And the individual that they took a picture or that they're doing a comparison of is Chelsea Manning, which some would argue is not necessarily a complete representation of transgender service members. I would argue, you know, we have a Navy SEAL who is part of SEAL Team 6, which is notable for killing Osama bin Laden, who's openly trans. Logan Ireland, who had a documentary on him about 2 years ago. You know, you want to talk about a service member who is putting their life on the line for our country, you know, look at those individuals. I would also, you know, I think it's also absurd that they're putting an F-35 in comparison to transgender individuals, because an F-35 costs roughly about $17 billion. So the estimates on all healthcare related to trans individuals who are currently serving, the 15,500 is about 8.4 million at the max per year. And that's the high end when the Pentagon did its study. So, I mean, like, there's no comparison here. $8.4 million is not going to pay for a new jet for the Air Force or a new ship for the Navy. I mean, like, that's absurd. And the military already substantially, you know, pays service members health care. Like, this is not, you know, this is not a big deal. In the grand scheme of things, we have a $657 billion budget for the Department of Defense. You know, I mean,
well, right. It's, I mean, the apples and oranges are ridiculous. I mean, they don't have somebody with an appendicitis in, you know, one picture and the picture of a plane on the other. I mean, it's, you're not picking,
well,
you know, procedures versus, you know, equipment.
Again, this is the type of thing that we can expect from the Family Research Council. The FRC and the Heritage Foundation have also been pushing hard on leadership to make a rule change which would allow the Hartzler Amendment to go through on the entire appropriations package. But this is now being fought by moderates. Representative Carlos Curbelo, who's a Republican moderate from Miami, has opposed this. The congressman told the press corps earlier today, or this evening, I should say, that leadership should respect the will of the House. That's already been expressed, referring to last Thursday's vote. The congressman continued, these transgender service people are serving our country, have signed up and agreed to risk their lives for this country, so we want to honor that commitment as well. Another moderate was a little bit more blunt. Hartzler had her shot. She lost. But see, this is that picture that you just described that Matt and you were talking about, and the fact that they're now effectively trying to jam it in as a procedural thing on the appropriations bill itself, which is being fought. Now, I'm being told by my sources on the Hill that it's probably not going to happen. But this is one of the things that people have to be concerned with. For example...
Before you move on that, because you brought up a point, I want you to dig into that in a little more detail. What exactly does that mean that they're trying to do? Those terms are kind of vague in terms of they've lost this one. How are they trying to resurrect it again?
The group of representatives from the House Armed Services Committee, including Hartzler, are trying to urge Speaker Ryan and the leadership team, which include Majority Leader McCarthy, to use a House procedural trick, which would automatically include that proposal or a Hartzler amendment into the entire appropriations package, okay, and essentially put it through for a vote that way. Now, that would literally mean an up or down vote on the entire budget request, okay? She's maintaining that steps must be taken, okay, to address this misuse of our precious defense dollars. Now, that goes back, speaking to the picture that you and Matt just discussed. You know, Hartzler went on. She said this policy hurts military readiness and will take over $1 billion from the Defense Department's budget. That's not true. But, see, by trying to put this in as a rule change where it would go on to the appropriations as part of the package would force the House to either accept it or throw the whole budget out. Okay. Now, I've got senior Republican sources telling me that the leadership is probably going to reject that. They don't want to go down that fight. And
right.
One of the major reasons for that is because of the fact, okay, that the Defense Secretary himself has more or less stepped in and said, look, I don't need this. I don't want this. This is not anything to do with morale, lethality, readiness. But you have people, a hawk who supports the amendment, Representative Franks, who also sits, he's from Arizona, and he sits on the House Armed Services Committee, and he said this afternoon. It's not so much that the transgender surgery issue as it is as much as we want to continue to let the defense bill be the mule for all these social experiments that the left wants to try to hoist on the government. It seems to me, and all due respect to everyone, that if someone wants to come into the military, potentially risk their life to save the country, that they should probably decide whether they're a man or a woman before they do that, which echoed a speech that was made last Thursday before the House vote by Representative Duncan Hunter of California. So what you're seeing here is the same pushback from the same people trying a procedural trick to run this through. But
right.
This time you've got leadership saying, no, you know, well, again, my sources are trying. Now, Matt and his folks may be hearing something different, but I've got congressional sources telling me leadership's probably not going to bite at that. Matt?
I think, in the Politico article today that was written about it, I think there were a few moderates that were like, you know, to what Brody stated, you know, like she had her shot and it, you know, it was 214-209. Like, it already went for a vote. I think Carlos Curbelo said that from Florida. I believe Ileana Ross-Lighton has made a similar statement today. I think using a procedural trick, because what they're trying to do is called a self-executing rule, which would mean that they would attach this amendment to a rule, to the rule that, you know, Congress has to pass the appropriations budget, right? So if in order for them to get these appropriations, everybody has to vote for the rule. So the theory would be that, or how the rule, or how this self-executing rule works is when Congress votes for that rule, they're also voting for that amendment. There's no separation. They don't get a separate vote on the amendment itself, which puts a lot of the moderate Republicans in a very bad situation who voted with us, 23 of them, because it was 24 and then one changed their vote at the last minute. So it puts them in a really bad spot because now they're on the record with the Hartzler Amendment, and they're trying a very procedural trick, you know, to Brody's point, to try to get it attached to the overall appropriations bill, which is, it's, you know, it would be unfathomable to me that the leadership, after they've already forced Congress to take a vote on this, would then again try to get them to do this amendment.
Right.
I think it's dangerous for them. I don't think it's something that is wise for them to do, particularly if they want to try to retain control of Congress in 2018, because one, you know, there's a lot of legal scholars who think that this trick, this rule, already has unconstitutional values to it. So I think if they do it this way, it has a much stronger chance in court of being struck down, and I don't see any court holding it up. And then the second part is, you know, they've taken this vote, you know, in order for the FRC and Heritage Foundation have tried to use our issues as wedge issues for decades, you know, and they lost. And in order for a wedge issue to be effective, it has to be a winning issue. And
right.
I think my personal opinion is that the fact that we had 23 Republicans vote with us and that amendment went down, it's starting to erode that image that we were just talking about. My hope is that the loss that they took last week is starting to erode that messaging for them, that it's not going to work anymore. You know, you try to attach a bathroom bill in Texas or Oklahoma or whatever, it can be hard for us to message. You come after a service member who wears a uniform, whether they're trans, gay, black, Latino, doesn't matter. You're wearing a uniform and you're defending this country. And we have an all-volunteer force. So I think people have a very big deference to individuals who are serving. And I think it was a big mistake for them to try to go after service members, period.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, I often think that the nullification of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was one of the things that actually put momentum to marriage equality. Because once you have public acknowledgement that you have heroes out there who are LGBT, then to turn around and deny them additional rights that everybody else has is unconscionable. I want to ask, though, one question with you guys. Okay, and we've only got a few more minutes left. We're actually down to 2.5 minutes. What about the Senate? Is this going to come up again when this goes over to the Senate?
My sources are telling me that right now we're kind of looking at this as it's a probably not. Senator McCain, who's the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has made it known to the members, even though he's currently out sick. He said before and previous that he agrees with the Secretary of Defense that he wants a clean NDAA. I also don't believe, and Matt can correct me, but I don't think they've got support even within that committee to try and go that way with it, Matt.
I think that, you know, Senator McCain, even though he's a Republican, and, on behalf of my organization, we wish him and his family well. That's a very tough diagnosis to be dealing with. And he is an American patriot. I was actually getting a lot of conversations from people about, you know, why are you wishing him well? And I'm like, the guy had, you know, he has cancer. And then I came about to who he is as a person, you know, very similar to the secretary. He's very pragmatic. You know, he will listen to you. He's not always going to agree with you, and he's not going to always do what you want him to do. But he is pragmatic, and he gives a lot of deference to the Defense Department. So I don't see it being an issue in the Senate. I don't think that they have the votes to do it. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, and there's a number of other senators.
Matt, thanks. I cut you off because we're about to be cut off. Appreciate you both being on. Thank you so much. Hope people got a lot out of this discussion. I think they should be vigilant on what's going on and watch the different sources, especially the ones that you guys are attached to, for follow-up information to know what they can do. I also want to highlight, if folks listening, listen to Out in Santa Cruz, www.ksco.com, Saturday night at 7 p.m. We will be talking about more issues. We're going to be talking about people of color and pride, this Saturday. Bash is returning to the show there. So it's Robin Bash on out in Santa Cruz. Again, Matt, for all, can't say thank you big enough. And likewise, Brody, all the work you do on behalf of the community. You guys are the true heroes, and I really appreciate it. Listen to Rated LGBTQ Radio next week, and we will see you then.
Thank you.
Thank you.